Welcome, welcome everyone. This is Amy Hall, and I want to give a big thank you to Tim for filling in for me for a couple of weeks. I really appreciate that, and he always does a great job. Greg, how are you today?
Yes, ma'am. Well, people don't know, a lot of times we do this early in the morning. Well, early for me, 8:30 here, and I'm still waking up.
All right, well, let's wake you up with some questions.
Yes, ma'am.
Here's a question from Jen Cook. Any thoughts on why the name Jesus is only mentioned in the New Testament? We see clear evidence of the person who would be Jesus in the Old Testament, quote, God with us and Emmanuel in Isaiah, just not Jesus.
Well, that's an interesting question, one I've never been asked before. And it seems like this falls maybe into the category of God revealing things when they need to be revealed. Okay, and God doesn't jump the gun and kind of give the whole layout of everything. We have what's called progressive revelation. So we have the first reference to Jesus actually in Genesis 3, when a son of Eve, pardon me, will fight the snake and strike a fatal blow on the snake, but he will suffer too. So no names or anything, and actually it's very vague as far as it goes. And then we see more characterizations. He shall be called in these things in Isaiah that you just mentioned, and Emmanuel and Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, whatever these different things that it mentions there. And they're meant to be characterizations. The actual given name is not so important at any given time. It isn't a prophecy that he will be named Jesus, because that doesn't happen accidentally. That name is given, just like John's name is given. It's a given name. In other words, God decided the name, you know, and you shall call his name Jesus because he shall save his people from their sins. And John the Baptist's name was given there in the vision to Zechariah there in Luke chapter 1. So there are sometimes then God assigns the name, and he doesn't do that until it's necessary. That is, when the child's about to be born and then named, then God gives the name if he has one in mind. So it's not at all unusual. We do have characterizations, but the name isn't given until it's needed to be used, just prior to the birth in both cases of John and Jesus, John the Baptist. So it doesn't strike me as unusual. The question is more or less a curiosity, I guess. There's nothing theologically weighty about the issue, but it just follows the pattern of God revealing what's necessary at the time and not going into a lot more detail if it's not necessary. There's plenty of stuff, 66 books, you know, to already be concerned with. So I think that that's probably the reason.
I can imagine, too, if they had announced – if a prophet had announced the name ahead of time, that could actually cause some problems, because then you could have people claiming that name or naming their children that name in hopes that they would be the one. And then people would say now, oh, they just named him Jesus because they wanted to fulfill that prophecy. Mm-hmm. So I think there are a lot of downsides, and I agree with you that it's not really the pattern of what God usually does.
Right. So. Some people may not know that the name that Jesus was given, Yeshua, is the same name as Joshua, who was one of the believing spies and leaders of the and kind of a disciple of Moses. And he's a fighter. He's a warrior. He's, when I say believing spies, the 12 spies that went into the land of the book of Numbers, 10 gave a bad report. And there were two, which included Joshua, who said, no, I know that land is filled with giants, but it's promised to us by God. Let's fight against the overwhelming foe and we will succeed because God is with us. Well, that isn't the idea that prevailed, but Joshua prevailed into the next generation, was able not only to enter the promised land, but lead the Jews after Moses died. So we have in Joshua a picture then of the mighty warrior who will lead his people and conquer and obtain the promised land. And so this is why, and actually I think the word Joshua, it means the Lord saves or something like that if you look at the etymology of it. So it's an appropriate name for Jesus, and it's meant to communicate to the people at the time more detail about the particular role of that person being born of Mary. He shall save his people from their sins.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take a question from Reagan. God is described as an immaterial being, yet Jesus' resurrected physical body displayed nail wounds in his hands. Are we to understand that Jesus still has a physical body after his ascension? If so, is it untrue that the Godhead is truly immaterial, at least not anymore?
Well, an important distinction. Well, the answer is to the first question is yes, he does have a material body. Okay, and but here's where an important distinction needs to be made. In the incarnation, God didn't become a man. Okay, God took on human nature and added it to his divine nature. Now, I think it's a mistake to be thinking about this as a kind of amalgam. So you have an immaterial God that has three persons as his essential nature, tripersonal, three centers of consciousness, and then have kind of wrapped around that the immaterial being, a physical shell called the body of Jesus. I think there's a temptation to think that way, and the question suggests that's what's in mind. Now, is God this kind of thing? And I don't think God's ontology didn't change. That means the nature of his existence, the substance of his self, did not change at all. The Word, the third person of the Trinity, took on a human body to create an unusual amalgam of sorts there, called the God-man, where Jesus is fully God and fully man, one person and two natures, the Chalcedonian formula that identifies orthodoxy regarding Christology there. And so in that sense, the second person of the Trinity continues to have a human nature, but in this case now glorified. The fact that the wounds in his hands were still obvious is an indication that it was his body that was resurrected, though in a glorified form, and he was not just a ghost. You see, this is another problem, and I think it was Bill Craig who I first heard mention this. This is a problem with trying to make the apparent appearances of Jesus post-resurrection just a hallucination. Because if the disciples, their mindset wasn't that Jesus, if they saw Jesus, they would think he was raised. They would think he was a ghost. And that's why he said in one of the appearances, "I'm not a ghost." So their tendency was not to believe in a resurrection. Their tendency was to believe, given something happening in front of him, that they were seeing a ghost. And so instead, we see, look, my hands, my feet, my side. And so we have the actual body that was raised. What that means is the body that was in the tomb is no longer there. It's an empty tomb because his body was lifted up, raised, and transformed. The mortal puts on immortality. And Paul says that in 1 Corinthians, talking about the nature of the resurrection. So we have every reason to believe that Jesus has a physical body now, that the incarnation is a permanent thing, but that doesn't mean that God, in the largest sense, his ontological nature is somehow physical. No, it's not. It's always non-physical, and it's non-changing. That's another important thing. He didn't become, change from one to the other, but rather added to the divine nature of the second person, the Word, a physical body in the incarnation. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. I wouldn't say that the Godhead has an immaterial body.
Right.
I mean, has a material body. It's the person of Jesus who has a human nature and a material body.
Actually, that's kin to an ancient heresy called Patripassianism, which held that it was the Father who had the body and suffered on the cross. And if the Godhead had the body, then the Father would be suffering in that sense, and that was rejected by the church fathers.
Okay, thanks for that, Greg. Let's go on to one from Love, Hope, Faith. In Mark, Jesus says quite a few times that people have to be quiet about who Jesus is or about the miracles he's done. What do you think this means, especially because other times Jesus seems fine with people knowing who he is?
Well, fine with knowing who he is, you mean as the Messiah? Like a woman at the well, I guess, earlier
in
John.
Yeah.
Well, I think it had to do with PR. It sounds weird, but on the one hand, Jesus did not want his identity revealed by demons. Okay? John the Baptist was the forerunner. In fact, John the Baptist, from the beginning, identified Jesus as the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Okay? So it wasn't that this was a big secret, but it was important at the means by which that was communicated. And so on the one hand, Jesus apparently did not want demons to be PR agents for him. We know who you are, the Holy One of God. Shut up. Get out. Okay? Then there were other times, though, where demons were not in view, but exuberant people who were the beneficiaries of Jesus' kindness through healing, who made a big deal about what Jesus did, completely understandably. But what ended up happening? The mobs began coming to Jesus for healing. Also understandable. However, that was the end of it. They came to get something personal. So this would be the equivalent, maybe in a very broad sense, of the word faith movement, the claim it and name it and claim it. And Jesus, he makes a reference to this in John chapter 6. You know, Jesus actually fed thousands more than once. In John chapter 6, we have the bread of life discourse where he feeds the people and he first chides the people for coming to see a miracle. They just want to be entertained. And then he chides them that because you're back to get a free meal. That's what you're all about. You're not here to hear about the bread of life, which is me, but you're here to get free bread. And he said, I'm the bread of life. I'm the one who came down from heaven. And then he has this very bizarre statement, you must eat my flesh and drink my blood. And I actually think this was meant to shock them out of their literalness. And they went, oh, and then they left when Jesus wasn't going to kind of play along with their notions. So that was the end of his popularity, actually. That was midway in his ministry, and there was a shift in his great period of popularity went on the wane then, and he spent more time with his disciples in Gentile lands, discipling them and preparing ultimately for his death. So it was a shift in his ministry. Why? Because he had to forcibly, in a certain sense, tell people, I am not this false view of a Messiah that, you know, portion every garage, chicken in every pot kind of deal that you're looking for to conquer the Romans at this time, whatever. You got it wrong, and you're not listening. So I think this is another reason why Jesus said, don't make a big fuss out of this. He was meeting a great personal need in human beings at the moment. Now, it's interesting when he tells the woman at the well that he's the Messiah. He has not worked any great work that they can come to benefit from illicitly, like multiplying bread and loaves and fishes. He actually identifies her sin by knowing supernaturally her sinful condition. And this amazes her. And so she goes and tells her, here's a man who told me everything that I've ever done. Could he not be the Messiah? So they're not going to come to get their sins revealed publicly to everybody else. You know, they're going to come to get something else. So there's no problem with her knowing he's the Messiah and having a kind of a miraculous event surrounding it and then going to tell others. That was kind of an appropriate pattern. But when you have the feeding of the 5,000, which was a tremendous, it's the only, apart from the resurrection, it's the only miracle that's repeated in every gospel. And it's a powerful characterization of his messianic office. They get it wrong. They go south. And so this is one of the reasons I think Jesus is saying, okay, the lepers, I'm telling you, you know, here, I'm healing you. Go show yourself to the priest as a testimony to them. But don't make a big fuss with all the other people, because then you're going to have a lot of people coming to him, and he's mm-hmm. going to be overwhelmed, which he was. So I think that's it's a conventional explanation, what I just offered, and didn't make it up. Although I did, you know, thinking about this woman at the well situation, I think that's a good counterexample, and you could see the differences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I did think that up on my own self.
Yeah, I think that's a great thought. I hadn't actually never thought about that difference. I think that's probably relevant. Also, you know, there are certain things that we get from Jesus when I say we get from, like, we learn about Jesus when he's with crowds. So things like the big miracle of feeding everyone and showing his power over nature and his desire to provide and all these things. And we learn teaching from him, so he'll teach in front of crowds. But what we see when he's with individuals is something more. We see his heart. We see his compassion for an individual. We see grace. We see love. We see gentleness and kindness. And, you know, I think about the woman who, you know, washes his feet with her hair, or puts the
ointment
on him, or the man who's born blind. Or we see these smaller acts, and we learn a lot about Jesus from that. Those kinds of things were not possible when the crowds were pressing in on him, mm-hmm. except in cases like where the woman touched him and he turns around and we see, you know, something there. But it's a lot harder for him to interact with people individually in crowds like that, other than just healing.
And by the way, in that case with the woman with the hemorrhage, he wasn't what's the right word? He wasn't an active agent in the normal sense. It isn't like he turned and said, "You're healed." She had enough faith to knowing that if I just touch his cloak, that's all I need. You know, he can keep walking. You know, and then Jesus realized what had happened and pointed it out mm-hmm. and identified her faith. She was scared too.
Yeah. So I think Jesus wanted to reveal both aspects of those things, and so that's probably why he wanted to hold off having the giant crowds at the beginning. You know, if he goes to different towns and he has people who interact with him on an individual basis, those people will tell others how he acted and spread it from there. But as soon as he can't go from place to place easily, now...
Well, this is why he was out in the wilderness preaching to the 5,000. So it was an act of mercy to provide food. There's no place for them to get food, mm-hmm. you know, but he had to go to those kinds of places because the mobs were so big.
Mm-hmm. So let's do one more. This one is from Richard Thompson. Hi, Amy and Greg. Could Matthew be accused of proof texting, or indeed, quote, reading a Bible verse when applying certain Old Testament passages to Christ's birth? For example, Matthew 1:23 and Isaiah 7:14, Matthew 2:6 and Micah 5:2, and perhaps especially in Matthew 2:15 and Hosea 11:1.
Well, the first reference is to a virgin shall give birth, and there, and this is in the Old Testament is Alma, which is a young woman in the Hebrew. But it's interesting when you read the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation that the Jews made of the Old Testament prior to the time of Christ. That word is actually translated Parthenos, which means virgin. I mean, it's a singular meaning. It's univocal. A young woman could be a young woman who's a virgin. So that's vague, but not Parthenos. So there's something about the passage that this is a problem for us. Thousands of years later, reading an ancient text that was from a different language at a different time in a different location. That's why it's helpful for us to go back to how those in that milieu responded or understood the text. And I think that helps us. There's a more extended explanation of that Isaiah 7 passage that that we don't have time to go into right now, but that one particular point that the Jewish scholars prior to the time of Jesus understood that to be a virgin is significant. And the other passages, I don't have them in front of me, but this is a broader category of things where you have New Testament writers quoting Old Testament verses, which we now read and don't see what they saw. And so therefore, that does raise the question, what about the principle, never read a Bible verse? That is, if you isolate a verse, you can add meaning or make it mean, look like it means something than it does when you read the flow of thought where it's contained. Well, sometimes when you read the flow of thought where these verses are contained, I think that there is an intimation of the meaning, but lots of times there isn't. Even in the book of Hebrews, we have references back to Psalms, and you think, man, where did that come from, you know? So I have a couple of different ways of explaining that, and I don't know that any is completely adequate to cover all the bases. But one of the things is something that I just mentioned. The original readers had an original understanding and insight into the writings and the genre and the language that we don't have now, and that made the reference by the New Testament writers made sense or make sense to them. So because of that, I see that, you know, there's something there, you know. Just like when we read back into the Isaiah, wonderful columns, Lord, unto us a son shall, child shall be born to us, unto son, us a son shall be given. Well, you know, that seems like a parallelism where there's just different ways of saying the same thing. But now we know that that individual that was being spoken of was the eternal Son of God that was given and born as a child. Okay, so now this puts us in a little opposite situation. We now in beholding the fulfillment of that, we see something in that they might not have seen, the dual nature of Christ intimated there in that passage. But the reverse certainly is true. And I think the Isaiah 7 is an example of that in those translations to the Septuagint. So sometimes you just see something. Another thing is that sometimes these are passages that do have they are typological. So you read in the birth narratives, and so the prophecy was fulfilled, out of Egypt I will call my son. Because there was an escape to Egypt, you know, for 2 years when Jesus was an infant. Well, there's no prophecy that says that. But what you have is you have a history of Israel where they go to Egypt in exile, and then they are brought out of Egypt into the promised land. So it's not a prophecy in the way we think of prophecy, but the writer is intimating that this is a prophetic type or example of what happened to Christ. See, it happened there. This is a picture of what Jesus was doing. So that's another way of understanding this. And the third thing, and this is my ultimate fallback if I can't figure it all out, is that these are guys that were functioning under the direction of the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit can convey to the New Testament writers that there was a divine intention of some of these passages in the Old Testament to be hints at something that was happening in the future. And when these things happened, they could look back, just like I mentioned about the child is born, a son is given, they could look back and say, oh, with divine insight now, oh, yeah, that's what was going on. There's a little hint. And there are lots and lots of these kinds of things that they see beginning to be tied together. So the New Testament authors then have something that we don't have, and that is the authority of the Holy Spirit to make this insight. It doesn't give us liberty to find whatever we want. Mm-hmm. And we don't have the skills to find those little hints usually. I mean, sometimes they're more obvious, like I said about the child is born, son is given. But other times, no, we don't. We need the help of the divine author. Now, this is why I'm careful about how I use fulfilled prophecy in Jesus' life as an apologetic, because a lot of the fulfilled prophecy, 300 and some prophecies fulfilled in the life of Christ, well, a lot of these are not going to be ones that are compelling to people when they look at the Old Testament reference and the New Testament fulfillment. They're going to go, huh? And that's because of this inside concern that we're talking about. And so I'm not going to make that kind of reference. I'm just going to talk about those prophecies that can be clearly identified as messianic prophecies that were understood as such back then and fulfilled. And even if in Jesus, and even if not understood then, like Psalm 22, we look back now and we see, gosh, that reads like a crucifixion. We see all the details there of a first-person account of, that is, the subjective account, the person being crucified, observing the scene. And so this is a powerful prophecy fulfilled in the life of Christ, down mm-hmm. to the dividing of the garments and et cetera, and they're pierced in hands and feet, et cetera. So this is a generalized explanation of how these things are done, and certainly Spirit-filled and apostolic witnesses with the authority of Christ to speak for him have authority that we do not have. We are still obliged by the rule, never read a Bible verse.
Right.
That is, we want to understand our interpretations in light of the flow of thought of a given passage.
And one of the reasons why we do that is because we don't want to make the Bible about us. So I don't want, it's not a good idea for me to go in there and say, oh, this Bible verse is saying something specific to me, or this is about me specifically, a special message just to me. The Bible is not about us in that way, but the Bible is about Jesus. So that's another difference between doing that mm-hmm. for, you know, interpreting things, you know, never read a Bible verse to be like meaning something that is special for us versus hinting at something that would be mm-hmm. true about Jesus later on.
Yeah, and this is the abuse that I address in that talk, one of the abuses, and that is that people are just finding private messages for themselves. And this certainly is not the case that's just been described about the New Testament writers in the Old Testament. They're not finding private messages for themselves. They are finding public messages that are kind of hidden that they have insight regarding that pertains to Jesus and God's purposes, and therefore have application for the entire church community and not just for one person. That's a good distinction, Amy.
All right. Thank you, Greg. And thank you, everyone, as always, for your questions. We look forward to hearing from you more on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. So please keep those questions coming. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.